Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your phone calls and address questions that you might want to raise here on the air. Questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or Christian life. Perhaps questions about your own spiritual journey. Or maybe you have questions about the validity of some answer you've heard from this host and you have a difference of opinion and would like to balance comment. Feel free to do that. We welcome those kinds of calls as well. You'll need this phone number and a phone. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Those of you who live in or near Temecula may be interested in knowing that this Saturday night we're conducting a meeting that we conduct once a month. It's only once a month that we gather in Temecula on a Saturday night. We meet at a little schoolhouse, which is on the property of the Temecula Community Church. If you don't know where that is, there's a map and an address and so forth at our website. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'm going to be speaking again on the essentials, the non-negotiable points of the Christian faith. And what I mean by that is that there are negotiables. There are matters upon which Christians can disagree and still be Christians. And matters where disagreement should not in any way impugn the character or the validity of a person's Christian testimony just because they have a difference of opinion. But there are some things, some opinions, that are certainly the bare minimum of what a Christian must believe to be called a Christian. And that's what we're going to be discussing again as we did the last time last month. That's this Saturday night. And you can find directions to the meeting at our website, thenarrowpath.com. You're all welcome to join us. Our first caller today is Mike from Midway City, California. And we have lines open also at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Mike, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Before I ask my question, I always learn something from your answers. I enjoy your answers very, very much. My question has to do with Abraham's and his faith. In James chapter 2, verse 22, it says Abraham's faith was by works, was made perfect. So does faith or saving faith have like three parts? You have to hear the information or the knowledge, and then you believe, and then the obedience and or the works, you act upon it. And my other question has to do with in Genesis chapter 15 about Abraham, God told Abraham to take certain animals and cut them in half, cut them in two. And is there some symbolism here? It says the birds of prey landed on the carcass and he drove them away. And then there was a smoking furnace and a burning torch. Is there symbolism here we're supposed to learn?
Yes, I'm sure there is, and I'll be glad to address it. As far as Abraham's faith is concerned, it's interesting how James makes it very clear that one's obedience to God is a mark of their faith. And one's obedience to God is the completion of their faith. That believing in God is one thing, but it's only the beginning of a life of faith. Faith is the whole life of the believer, but that life includes works. So in a sense, we could say faith includes works. But the question of how it includes them is a matter of fine points of difference of opinion among many Christians. Some, like the Roman Catholic Church, feels that we're saved by a combination of faith plus works. So you must have faith, of course, to be a Christian, but you also have to do certain works to be justified. Protestants usually say, no, you only have to be justified by faith alone. And some go so far as to suggest that faith might even be without works. The Bible, however, teaches something that I think is between these two, and that is that faith indeed is that which justifies. God is looking for people who have faith. Now, faith in the Greek, pistis, is a word that means trust and confidence and so forth, but it also means faithfulness. It's an interesting thing that the same word in the Greek is used for faith and for faithfulness in some cases. And so what God's looking for is people who have faith and who are faithful to him. Now, faithfulness is a character trait that resides in you, even if you're paralyzed from the neck down and can't do anything either faithful or unfaithful. Faithfulness is a character trait. But if you are not paralyzed from the neck down, and if you are going out living your life and doing things, your faithfulness will be manifested in the things you do, in your faithful obedience to God. A person who doesn't obey God obviously doesn't have that kind of faith or that faithfulness to God. And so that being so, James can talk about how Abraham offering his son Isaac was a manifestation and a completion, as it were, of his faith. Lots of people, Protestants especially, who are very, very, obsessed with avoiding any overlap between their view and the Roman Catholic view. Mm-hmm. That is, they're afraid that they might sound too Roman Catholic or be too Roman Catholic if they admit any place for works. Mm-hmm. I think Christians sometimes like that overreact and don't give enough place to works. Certainly the Bible teaches in James, but also in writings of Paul, that works are the outgrowth and a necessary outgrowth of genuine faith. So that Paul says in Galatians 5:6, what matters to God is, Paul says, a faith that works through love. So it's a faith that works. It's not really faith plus works. It's not as if faith gets you part of the way saved and a certain number of works have to be added to that to get you the rest of the way saved. You are saved by faith alone, but it is a faith that works through love. So if what you call faith is not producing works of love in you, then it isn't the faith that God is interested in. Or as A.W. Tozer used to say, he said, any faith that doesn't make a difference in your life, why should it make a difference to God, either? Faith should make a difference, and it will if it's genuine. So Abraham's faith was. Now, you asked about that peculiar experience Abraham had when God cut a covenant with Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. And it's generally understood a certain way by evangelical scholars, but I kind of see it a slightly different way, although, of course, this is ambiguous enough that more than one opinion would have to be tolerated about it. Abraham was told to take certain animals and divide them in two and lay them out in the manner that was very customary for Middle Eastern covenants to be made. Now, covenants were usually agreements between two parties, usually human parties, sometimes between two nations. The rulers of two nations would make a covenant, be like a mutual non-aggressions pact or a covenant in which a vassal state would pledge their loyalty to the suzerain or the conquering state. But in any case, when people made covenants in the Middle East, they did a very strange thing. They'd take an animal or more, cut it in two. This is the corpse of an animal. And they'd lay the body parts across from each other, and then the parties participating in the covenant would move between those parts. That is, they'd walk between those parts. And it was a very strange symbolic gesture. We have, actually, archaeologists have found an interesting inscription associated with one of these covenants that isn't in the Bible, just as a Middle Eastern man not known to us named Meta'ilu. And basically, his covenant was, if Meta'ilu breaks this covenant, may he be torn in two like these animals are torn in two. So the cutting of the animal in two is to be a picture of the unbreakable commitment of the parties in the covenant. Now, here, God's making a covenant with Abraham, but Abraham himself doesn't pass between the pieces of the meat and so forth. God tells him to lay out these animal parts, and yet God doesn't show up for a long time. And it starts to get dark, and the animals are attracting vultures. And Abraham has to chase the vultures away while he's waiting for God to show up to make this covenant. But Abraham gets sleepy, and he begins to be terrified. Perhaps he's terrified that the vultures will take the meat while he sleeps, or else it's a supernatural or preternatural terror that comes upon him. But God appears to him and speaks to him. Now, I believe that what he speaks to him is concerning the same thing that he appears to him as, but some see it otherwise. What God says to him at this point is in verse 13 of Genesis 15, God said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." Now, this is talking about Abram's descendants going into Egypt. Egypt is not named, but that's how it came out.
Right.
The Israelites went into Egypt, and they were afflicted there 400 years. And then they came out in the Exodus. So this is what God is promising. And then Abram is given this visual sign. In verse 17 it says, "It came to pass, when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there was a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces of the animals. And on the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land,'" and he lists the territory that he's giving them. Now, what he has promised is that he's giving Abram's descendants the land of Canaan where he was, but that before that, before he would give it to them, they were going to have to spend 400 years afflicted in a foreign country, Egypt. But then they would come back and he'd give them this land. This was God's covenant that he's making. And the visual was that there was a smoking oven and a burning torch passing between the parts. Now, I'll tell you how most evangelicals interpret this and how I interpret it differently. Most evangelical commentaries will say that the smoking oven represents God the Father, and the burning torch represents Jesus. And therefore, the covenant was made between God the Father and Jesus. Usually people say this is significant because Abraham was not required to pass through. Only God in two persons of the Trinity did so, which means that Abram didn't have to do anything. He wasn't covenanting to anything.
Right.
And God was covenanting within himself to do this thing. So they would say God the Father and God the Son covenant together, an unconditional covenant with Abraham,
right,
that that God would give them this. That's the common thing to hear. Now, I used to hear that and teach that because I started out as a teacher teaching what I've been told. But I always was a little uncomfortable. I thought, well, how do we know that a smoking oven is a symbol for God the Father, or that a burning torch is a symbol for Jesus? I mean, we don't have that imagery anywhere else in Scripture. It sounded a little bit arbitrary. Although the vision was mysterious enough, you had to have some kind of explanation. So it seemed like, well, I guess that makes sense. But I was never quite convinced that there was biblical basis for saying the smoking oven represents God or the torch represents Jesus, simply because the Bible doesn't tell us that it does and doesn't hint that it does. And therefore, it's an arbitrary interpretation. Now, as I read the rest of the Old Testament later in life, I discovered something interesting. One is that the captivity of the Jews in Egypt is repeatedly referred to as the iron furnace or the oven. And in Deuteronomy 4:20 and in Jeremiah 11:4 and in 1 Kings 8:51, these are three places in the Old Testament where God speaks of having delivered Israel out of the oven or out of the furnace, meaning Egypt.
Really?
And then this smoking torch, I found interesting when I encountered a very similar phrase or term in Isaiah chapter 62 and verse 1, which says, "For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a lamp that burns." And actually in the King James Version, I think this torch is said to be a lamp also in Genesis. But it's interesting that God's salvation of his people is said to be like a lamp or a torch that burns. And the captivity in Egypt is like an oven or a furnace. And God has just spoken to Abraham about his descendants going into the land of Egypt as slaves for 400 years, but that God would deliver them and give them the land. And therefore, it could be that these two items represent the captivity in Egypt and God's deliverance, which are joined together as one. That is to say, God will not allow them to go into that captivity without the guarantee of his delivering them afterwards, and that these two images represent the two aspects of what he's verbally promised to Abraham there, namely the captivity and the deliverance. Anyway, that makes as much sense to me as the other interpretation, and it seems to have more cross-references in its favor.
Makes a lot of sense. And the vultures, does that mean anything?
The vultures coming down might have meant nothing at all, except it was just a phenomenon that because God delayed, they came. Or it might mean that the vultures coming down on the carcasses might be yet an image of the Egyptians afflicting the Israelites in Egypt, like unclean birds feasting on them. But I'm not going to be too strong on that point because I don't know of any cross-references that would identify that.
Right. Well, thank you very much for giving me the cross-reference for the smoking furnace and the
yeah. Spark. Those references again, if you have a pencil, are Deuteronomy 4:20. Jeremiah 11:4, 1 Kings 8:51, and then Isaiah 62:1. And it's also interesting that Jeremiah 34, verses 18 and 19, makes a reference not to this event, but to another covenant that was cut by passing between animal parts, and just another confirmation that this is how things were done in Jeremiah 34. Verses 18 and 19. I got to run, though. We've given you half the show. We got calls waiting.
Thank you, Stephen. God bless you.
God bless you, Mike. Thank you for calling. It's good to talk to you. Our next in line here is Gifford calling from Rancho Cucamonga. Gifford, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Steve.
Sure.
John 5:14, uh-huh. Jesus is speaking to the man that he's just healed by the pool of Bethesda, and he says, stop sinning, or an even worse disease or an even worse thing will come upon you. And he infers that if the man continues to sin, he will have some kind of disease brought upon him. Seems to infer that. What does that mean for us today as Christians?
Well, it might have some parallel to us as Christians, at least to some of us. But it's not necessarily a universal idea that sickness or disease comes on someone because of their sinning. So obviously, there are some maladies that come on people that are associated with their sins. For example, you know, cirrhosis of the liver from drinking too much, or lung cancer from smoking too much, or venereal disease from being too promiscuous. These kinds of things we can easily see sinning directly connected with sickness, but not always. Remember, there was that time that the disciples asked Jesus in John 9:1 about the blind man, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind, and Jesus said, neither. This man was just born blind so that the works of God could be seen in him. So it is sometimes the case that certain sins will bring certain physiological problems on a person, sicknesses. But it's also the case that sometimes there's no connection at all between sin and the problem that a person has physically, and it'd be wrong to assume that when somebody's sick, it's because they've sinned. Now, in the case of the man who was paralyzed at the pool of Bethesda, Jesus words him after he healed him, he said, sin no more, lest some worse thing come upon you. Obviously, he is suggesting, or seems to be hinting, that this man's original condition was caused by some sin that the man knew of. Now, we don't know what it was. Maybe he was paralyzed from a fall that occurred when he was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. I don't know. We have no record of the backstory. But Jesus assumed that the man knew what he was talking about. And when he said, sin no more, I don't think he means don't ever commit a sin again or else you're going to get sick again, because that would be a pretty heavy burden. I mean, we're not supposed to sin. But people do fall into sin, and if this guy had it hanging over his head, well, you're going to have worse than paralysis if you sin again in any way whatsoever. That'd be horrible, because the man would probably fall into that. But it may mean that the sin that you know caused this, don't do that again, or else it'll be harder on you next time. In other words, you know, consider this a slap on the wrist. There could be a worse one coming if you continue in the behavior that brought this about. And that is how I think most commentators probably understand Jesus' words in that place. It is how I think he meant it.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the answer. Thanks, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Okay, Gifford. Good talking to you, too. God bless you. It's great to hear from you. All right. Our next caller is Danny calling from Santa Ana, California. By the way, if you want to be on the air here, we do have a few minutes left, and we might be able to get your call through. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and the number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Danny, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Greg. Steve, I was reading Isaiah. I think it was near chapter 28. It was a couple of days ago, so I can't recall it specifically. And it was in the New King James Version. And he made reference to a flying, fiery serpent. And immediately what comes to mind is a fire-breathing dragon. But I was just wondering what that reference is.
Well, Isaiah 27, I think it is. I'm turning there now. But Isaiah 27:1 says, "In that day, the Lord with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he'll slay the reptile that's in the sea." Is that the passage or another one?
I believe that's it.
This
King James Version says, flying, fiery serpent.
Well, there could be another passage I'm not thinking of, but this one actually, I'm looking at the New King James, says the fleeing serpent. The serpent that is fleeing would be trying to escape. Now, there are references to fiery serpents in some passages in the Bible, more than one. In Deuteronomy, for example, I think God mentions that he took them safely through the wilderness where the fiery serpents were and so forth. But you're wondering if there could be fiery breathing dragons. And this is something that even if we don't find a verse in Isaiah that speaks of it, it does seem that the book of Job does speak of it. Now, Isaiah might also in some place, though that particular verse, I'm not finding the word fiery or fleeing or flying in that passage. But in Job, of course, in chapter 41, there's a description of a creature that is a reptile. It's called Leviathan, which is the same name that's used there in Isaiah 27:1. And it is said that sparks fly out of its nostrils. It says this in Job 41:19. Out of his mouth go burning lights, sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes from his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coils, and a flame goes out from his mouth. Now, apart from this detail of fire breathing, the creature sounds like a realistic description of a dinosaur. Now, we don't know of any dinosaurs that breathe fire. It's interesting that there are legends of fire-breathing dragons in many countries, and there may well be some memory of some kind of dinosaur that actually did breathe fire. Everything about the description of Leviathan in Job 41 is realistic and sounds like what we know to be dinosaurs, except for the fire-breathing part. But you see, he is describing creatures that Job had seen. God is describing horses and eagles and other creatures that were familiar, and he mentions Leviathan and describes them too. He's basically saying, look at these creatures around you and see what God has made. So, in other words, Leviathan was a living creature, just like horses and eagles were, that Job was familiar with, and was a huge reptile with huge scales, so thick that the Bible says that arrows couldn't penetrate the scales of its belly. Arrows would break against it like rotten or dried grass. And this creature could breathe fire. Now, everything else God has said in these descriptions of these animals is, something we can recognize. And so maybe we should recognize this as an eyewitness testimony to the fact that there were fire-breathing reptiles of some kind. But we don't know any more than what we have here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Danny, good talking to you. Thank you for your call. All right, we have a call next from, we've got two calls. One of them is Kevin from La Cañada, who's been waiting longer. Kevin, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, brother. Really appreciate your program. Considering salvation and that man has ultimately, three final destinations, either in the New Jerusalem, the nations, or the Lake of Fire, right?
One could argue that from Revelation 22. Uh-huh.
Okay, so I'm thinking, let's say a Christian has their salvation, and they fall away, right? And they die in the state where they've fallen away. Technically, even though they've been a Christian for a certain period of time during their life before they fell away, couldn't they be resurrected as a sheep and then be part of the nations? I mean, in other words, they still have their eternal life. It's just not in the holy city, the New Jerusalem. It's only in the nations.
Well, I can't confirm or disconfirm that. I will say there are some passages that can be understood that way. For example, there is in Revelation 22 a description, or 21 and 22, a description of the New Jerusalem, and there's mention of the kings of the nations, the kings of the earth, coming and going in and out of the city, and there are outside the city dogs and idolaters and, you know, evil people and so forth, but there's also the lake of fire. Now, it's hard to know exactly how we'd understand that. One could certainly understand the description as if certain people live in the city, certain people are part of the nations living outside the city and are ruled over by those who live in the city, and a third category are in the lake of fire. All three situations are described. Whether any of them are to be identified with others is hard to say, and most evangelicals would say that those who are outside the city are the same ones who are in the lake of fire. But that's not necessarily the case, because we do read that those outside the city come into the city from time to time. Likewise, the sheep and the goats. Sheep and the goats mentions the sheep, the goats, and the brethren of Jesus, as if they could be three categories. Usually the sheep are considered to be the same as the brethren, but obviously they are mentioned separately, and one could interpret it as if there's three groups. So what I'm saying is some of these passages could conceivably be interpreted the way you're saying, though they generally are not interpreted that way in evangelical circles. So it remains ambiguous, and I would not, like I said, be able to confirm or disconfirm the correct interpretation of those. There's too much ambiguity there and too little time. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us out, go to thenarrowpath.com and check out how. Thanks for joining us. God bless you.
Hello, good morning. We're glad you could join us today for this edition of The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Excuse me. We want to say thanks to our listeners, thanks to the callers, and of course, thanks to Steve. And we're so glad that you're along with us when we take this journey during The Narrow Path. And if you'd like to be able to support this ministry, and as you've heard Steve mention, they do not accept funding from other sources of any kind, just from a listener like you. They don't sell anything, and they certainly don't do any fundraising. So whatever you choose to give is going to go directly to keeping Steve on the air in this time slot here on KBright. So if you'd like to be able to do that, please go to Steve's website. It's thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find a place there. It's easy to navigate. You'll know right what to do once you're there at the website, thenarrowpath.com. However, if you'd like to be able to give and make a donation in another way, then please give us a call here at KBright, and we'll give you additional information. Our number is 800-227-2337. Please remember that the views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Joyce Meyer is what's coming up next right here on AM 740 KBright. The Bottom Line's Roger Marsh.
One of the big issues for people who do not like Obamacare is the fact that it seems like they're going to be the ones who get stuck paying for not only their own health care, but somebody else's as well. And it's true. The president has, you know, set up this plan so that everyone is going to be paying into the system. And yet, there are going to be some people who are going to be paying with government money.
Discerning Talk Radio, The Bottom Line. Weekdays at 3 on AM 740. KBright, strengthening the local body of Christ.
Southern California's only 50,000-watt Christian station, KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled, How to Release God's Power in Your Life. You've probably lived long enough now that you know life comes with its ups and downs. You have good days and bad days. On the good days, there is no problem you can't face. On the bad days, it seems like there is one big challenge after another.
Those days you can feel so weak and overwhelmed. It's as if God is distant and no help can be found. The truth is, though, God is closer to you in those times than you realize and ready to give you His power that you need to face those terrible days. You just have to learn how to tap into that power. And today, Joyce wants to show you how to do just that. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, how to release God's power in your life.
You know, Goliath, David had to face and square off with Goliath before, it was one of the things he had to go through before he could wear the crown. He was anointed to be king 20 years before he wore the crown. One of the things he had to do was square off with Goliath. Another thing he had to do was go through all his testing with being mistreated by Saul. Come on now. While he waited in faith for God's deliverance. That's another four-part series. And during those days, he ate nothing, and he was hungry. And verse 3 says, then the devil said to him, you ever notice that sometimes the devil waits till you're down? I don't know about you, but he talks to me more when I'm really tired than when I'm not. Then the devil said to him, if you, if